Welcome on to a Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Danny, we have a Game 7.
Yeah, we have a Game 7 in a series that people actually care about, too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would have thought that the Clippers did not have this in them. I thought maybe they could, and we talked about that they could win this game and control it even, which they kind of did. Because of the talent on the roster, and really, that talent came through. Blake Griffin and Chris Paul both just played their hearts out in this game. They were fantastic, and now you know the histories of Game 7. The Spurs have a tall mountain to climb. Home teams win about 80% of Game 7s.
Yeah, and John Schumann, I believe, tweeted out that in a strange, cruel irony, the only time the Spurs have won a road Game 7 was against Chris Paul in 2008.
Yeah, that's right, that New Orleans team that everyone forgets about.
Yeah.
So my main takeaway here was I thought this is the first game where it was palpable that the Clippers played harder than the Spurs did. And Coach Popovich was very critical of the team's effort in the post-game press conference. And I wouldn't say that it was obvious that they didn't try that hard. And I think the Clippers still made more mental mistakes than the Spurs did, but they were able to make up for it with superior effort, even though, as usual, their main guys had to play a ton of minutes.
Yeah, they absolutely did. I mean, one of the huge takeaways for me when you look at it in its totality with box scores, there were four Clippers that played more than 36 minutes, and there was only one Spur that played more than 32.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things was this game, really, the Spurs were very much in control. The Clippers came out like gangbusters in the first quarter, but weren't getting that much to show for it. Their activity level was really the best it was all game. They were getting out on the fast break, and that effort was similar to their effort in Game 5, but wasn't quite sustainable for them down the stretch of Game 5. And they certainly slowed in this game, but they came out with unbelievable energy. Blake Griffin and Chris Paul couldn't hit any shots in that first quarter, but Redick was able to keep them afloat with a great first quarter on his part.
Yeah, and it's also weird, kind of funny. You see these games every once in a while where, you know, a team puts out a really good effort, but then one of the things that stuck out to me is that the Clippers only made four threes. They were 22% from three-pointers, but they still played a hard game, played a pretty good game, and it's impressive to beat a team this good in San Antonio on the road despite having something like that, and the free throw disparity certainly helped with that.
Yeah, it did. A lot of that, of course, was the intentional fouling of DeAndre. A couple of notes from the first quarter that I thought were interesting. The Spurs splitter looked better, at least to start the game, and they went with three post-ups for him on Blake right away, and Blake got a foul, but then splitter wasn't able to score on the other two because they helped a lot. But the Spurs did get a couple of open shots off of that, but Blake only picked up one foul. Redick was being guarded by Kawhi, and he actually was able to shake loose from him quite a bit. Coach Popovich said that Kawhi didn't have his best game at all on the defensive end, nor did he offensively.
Yeah, and then another thing that was notable that in the first quarter is offensive rebounding, and that, I mean, the Spurs ended up having a two rebound advantage, but that could have been a bigger factor in the game. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it could have been. It was just a weird first quarter in a lot of ways. Just frenetic activity. Both teams ended up scoring only about a point per possession, but it was a pretty fast quarter for 25 possessions, which is a little faster than what these teams have been averaging. And the Clippers had a 24% steal rate in that quarter. The Spurs got 58% of the offensive rebounds, and the Clippers got 42%. So you can see how incredibly frenetic of a first quarter it was.
And then I guess we want to go straight into the second quarter. The first thing in the second quarter is Tim Duncan. You want to talk about that whole shenanigan?
Yeah, so Spurs are up, and, you know, by 10, they, of course, killed the Clippers bench. per usual, when Austin Rivers came in for Paul, they gave up 6 quick points at the beginning of the second quarter before Paul came back in. And it was really, you know, a 6-10 point lead throughout most of the second quarter until Greg Popovich went with the intentional fouling on Jordan. And Jordan was able to hit his free throws. He was 7-13 from the line in the first half. And then, in what was a disaster, Popovich decided to take it off, but Duncan had already committed a foul, which ended up being his second. And you would have thought that they would have just learned to never have Duncan give any of those fouls under any circumstances. But, you know, it's kind of, I think, the Spurs selfless culture that it doesn't matter who you are. The coach says foul, you foul. But they maybe could have been a little more judicious about it. And so, you know, it's hard for the players, too, because Pop's going to put it on. He's going to take it off. They discovered a new wrinkle where they would foul DeAndre before the ball was even inbounded so they could get 2 free throws out of him when they weren't even in the bonus. And but, you know, he hit 7-13, which was a very good rate. And then, of course, the Spurs had some more trouble scoring. They also did not go as much with Matt Bonner during the intentional fouling, which had been effective for them so they could actually score against the set defense. But it's tough. I mean, Bob Vulgar, they're playing good D. They were stopping him. And then they went to that tactic. Duncan got his second foul. Then he later picked up his third, and he was out of the game. They were up 7 at that point, 47-40. And they ended the half tied at 51 without Duncan. And Duncan, even more than Kawhi, is still the most essential player on the Spurs, especially with Splitter being as limited as he has been.
Did you have any other takeaways from the second quarter, or you want to move on to the second half?
Let's see. What else did I have here? Parker also was another guy. He, granted, probably wasn't as good as Mills in this game anyway, but he looked a little better, especially in the first half with his quickness. He was able to actually blow by and get in the lane for some shots. And he also ended up with 3 fouls and was in foul trouble at the end of the second quarter as well. But, I mean, it's very interesting, though, the strategy, because Popovich has these guys commit fouls like it doesn't matter that they might get in foul trouble later, because presumably he thinks they won't pick up any more fouls. And then he gets 1 more fouls and he takes out Duncan. But if you didn't think he was getting any more fouls, why does it matter that he has 3 fouls? You know, it's not really consistent. My biggest problem with the way the Hacko was implemented, and I think in all but one of the games, they really have not been successful with it. My biggest problem with it is just that it's very ad hoc. It seems, all right, we're going to foul him. He hits a couple. Now we're not going to do it anymore. You know, we're going to do it at a certain time when, you know, Chris Paul's out of the game. Probably not a great idea. You're going to stop him anyway. You know, now we're going to do it when Paul's in the game. We're going to put Bonner in. We're not going to put Bonner in. You know, the plan just didn't quite seem to be there on a strategy which is very nuanced and, you know, really is almost like a math exercise in some ways. You have to be very specific about it, and I didn't think the Spurs accomplished that.
Yeah, the way that I phrase it is that when you're doing Hacka, the plan has to be cohesive because you're completely changing the structure of the game, and you can use that to your advantage or you cannot. But the only way to make it worthwhile is to do things like using guys who their fouls don't really matter a lot. You do it by acknowledging the fact that you're not going to be playing defense for a little while, so you have, that's Matt Bonner's perfect for that. Kyle Anderson would be fine for it too. You do things like that, and you also need to make it easily discernible to the players, so that's why it's a cohesive strategy, and so the players get it. It's, as you said, the problem with it is that it's ad hoc, and it's surprising to me that there does not appear to be much consistency with the way the Spurs do it, because I thought even if they're going to, you know, even if they're going to do some weird stuff with it, at least you would have some sort of internal consistency, and I haven't seen that at all.
Yeah, Bob Vulgaris, who has been critical of the fouling strategy as we have, he had a good tweet that the Spurs offense was scoring 1.13 points per possession off a defensive rebound and only 0.93 after a field goal make. Certainly a free throw attempt is much closer to a field goal make when, you know, you're not going to get out in transition after that, even if it's a free throw miss. So that was, you know, it was really weird. I mean, the Spurs were playing great. They went to the Hakka. Duncan got in foul trouble, and the game completely shifted going into the third quarter.
Yeah, I completely agree. And going into the third quarter, then I feel like the first thing with that was Blake Griffin. Do we have a resolution on that right now?
Oh, you mean of like, he just kind of looked injured, and he was moving in a way where it seemed like he had a back issue, especially defensively a lot of times, or when he was running, he just sort of was keeping that tight lower back where you can tell someone's just not running with the fluidity that they normally would, but he was gutting it out. I mean, he didn't have really any dunks in this game, no real spectacular finishes at the basket. It was a marked contrast to how he played in game one when he was just so explosive. And so he still managed to gut it out. He got a lot of nice rim runs in transition where he was able to get deep post position and kind of just muscle up a shot and score. He had the mid-range jump shot working pretty well. And it was really a great performance by him when he clearly was not right physically. And especially in the third quarter, he got 10 shots up in the first 7 minutes of the third quarter, made five of them for 10 points, and he was able to keep them afloat until Chris Paul was able to get going. Paul, I think, was only 1 of 9 in the first half, and then he really got it going into the second half.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, I think it was in some ways important for him. I think he's a guy who's overly criticized in terms of his lack of playoff success. I think you can point to that his teams have generally been less talented, I would say almost exclusively less talented than the teams they've lost to. But it's good for him to do this in a big game because it takes the people who are unfairly criticizing him, and it gives him a little bit less ammunition.
Another key stretch, as it always tends to be in this series, was the end of the third quarter, early fourth quarter, you know, that middle section of the half when the Clippers would normally go to their bench. They had a lineup of Paul, Crawford, Austin Rivers, Big Baby, and Turkoglu. And that's when the Clippers decided to go with their double high set with those two pick and rolls that we've talked about so much. They really had kind of kept that in storage until that end period, and I think the plan was to just leave Paul in and let him operate. The Spurs still had no answer, even when, you know, they were guarding, they had Big Baby and Turkoglu setting the screen. I think really what you might have wanted to do at that point that they haven't ever done, and this is not really the way they defend the pick and roll, is just trap the pick and roll, make them throw it to Big Baby or Turkoglu. I mean, but what ended up happening was they set the screen, Paul would get downhill, he was getting the switch, and it wasn't even on Duncan. Duncan was out of the game, and Paul was able to just light up Splitter, light up Diog, get to his spots in the mid-range, and drain him. And, you know, I thought it was going to be a big problem because Rivers and Crawford were on the floor, and those guys, once you get it to him, they're not getting it back. But Paul just didn't pass it to those guys. And he shot basically every time except for finding Big Baby for a dunk on the roll. So it was a spectacular performance by him. Doc left him in all half. He was able to keep enough energy. I don't know where he found it from. He played, I think, 45 minutes total in the game. Just an unbelievable Chris Paul performance, especially in the second half.
Yeah, I'm super happy for him. Anything else in the third quarter? I mean, that kind of bridge it. Do you want to go to the fourth?
Well, during that period, Splitter was really bad offensively, and Duncan, I think, could have played more minutes in the second half. Maybe he's not capable of it. You know, there was a question for Pop at the presser after the game of if it's game seven, are you going to extend guys' minutes? And he said, yeah, some guys can take it, some guys can't. But, you know, with Duncan having not played that much in the first half, maybe he could have played a little more. But Splitter just flubbed a bunch of finishes inside. He basically, you know, if it had been Duncan in there, they would have had 6 points because he flubbed those finishes. And only got maybe 1 point. He was 1 for 2 from the line on a dubious call and just threw up some crap off the backboard another couple of times. So that was really rough. They were getting good shots during that period. You know, with guys like Rivers and Crawford, there just wasn't the communication or really just, you know, the kind of mindset that you need defensively. But they couldn't score, and Splitter was a big part of the problem.
So the Clippers go into the final quarter of an obvious must-win game, up 4 points. What were you thinking as that transition happened?
Well, I was thinking, are they going to leave Paul in, you know, or take him out, and can they hold on, basically, was my thought. And then also, when was Duncan going to come back in? I mean, you look at Splitter, he played 12 minutes in that second half, was minus 11, you know, a pretty well-earned minus 11, 2 out of 6 from the free throw line, 1 of 3 on field goals. And it was really that's only in the second half. So it was a really rough second half for him. And then Kawhi really, really struggled too. He only had 2 points in the second half, 0 for 6. Wasn't really able to stop Paul defensively either, even when they switched onto him. So it was a struggle. Tim Duncan was really the only Spur who played that well in the second half, along with Boris Diaw, who was amazing. He was able to score in the post. He had his right shoulder, which he doesn't necessarily like to go to, but he had his right shoulder, 1 foot fadeaway working on Griffin. He hit a three when there was a miscommunication. So Diaw was great. He kept him in it, but no one else for the Spurs other than he and Duncan played well in the second half. Well, I guess Marco Bellinelli would be the other. He was 3 out of 4 on threes in the second half.
Yeah, Marco, as somebody who covered him early in his career, it's always funny when he can pull out that 20-point game just out of absolutely nowhere, but just, I don't know, he does that sometimes.
Yeah, so another really interesting thing in that fourth quarter was down the stretch when the Clippers managed to maintain the lead pretty much the entire time. Blake continued playing well. He and Paul were really doing all the playmaking for the Clippers. They had 22 assists. Paul had 15. Griffin had 6. There's only one non-Paul or Griffin assist. All of the action was rolling through them. And they really, you know, had some nice individual shots. Jamal Crawford hit a nice shot over Tony Parker from the elbow to keep the lead at about 5. And the Spurs really were not able to get into one possession. The key play was, the Clippers were up 6. Bellinelli hit a 3 off an offensive rebound after missing his first attempt. So with about 40 seconds left or so, Clippers are up by 3. Doc calls a timeout, which, you know, sometimes you don't like a timeout, but this was a good one because he managed to get them to run the clock down, which they needed to do, but he used the early part of the clock to run a 1-2 pick and roll, get Kawhi off of Chris Paul and make it Patty Mills, who was closing the game with Parker not playing that well. And then Paul was able to reject the screen that was eventually set, get to his right hand, build up some speed, and then do a great jump stop just as Duncan was coming out, lofted a floater over him, and it was a 5-point game with about 30 seconds left, and that was it.
Yeah, that was it. We can, obviously there's more to talk about in this game, but possibility of now the eventuality of a game 7. How did this game affect the way that you think about the Clippers now getting a game 7 on their home floor?
Not at all, really. I think I would still make the Spurs, I don't know, it's just almost a pure toss-up to me. I think the Clippers, you know, they got to be getting pretty exhausted here. We'll see if they can sustain this type of effort. I didn't like the way Blake looked physically. We'll have to see it. Nothing has come out about what his status was. You know, that may be part of the problem, too, might be that he just kind of fell on his lower back. Maybe that's what the issue was when he got that hard foul in Game 5. But I'm really impressed with the way he was able to gut it out. He's had injury problems in past playoffs and wasn't able to quite contribute, but he was great in this game. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's really a pure toss-up. I guess I like the Clippers a little bit just because of the home court, especially the Game 7 traditional home court advantage. But, you know, these teams have basically fought to a draw in this series.
Yeah, and each team has won twice on the opponent's home floor, correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. Another issue for the Clippers potentially might be Big Baby had what was called a left ankle sprain. We couldn't see anything that looked like an ankle sprain. There's sort of tacit speculation by the broadcast that it might be an Achilles. They didn't even want to say what it was, which was kind of weird, but what they thought it was. But they're definitely, you didn't see any kind of eversion or inversion on that ankle for Big Baby. He injured as he was going up trying to contest a shot. I thought it might be, you know, some problem with his foot as well. But he was in a lot of pain. He had to be wheelchaired out to the locker room. So without him, then is it going to be Hawes? Are they going to just go small more? You know, those guys can't really extend more minutes than they already have. So it's going to be difficult for them in a Game 7.
Game 7, Spencer Hawes, baby.
I thought they should try Hawes and see if they could space the Spurs out a little bit more, because they haven't really been that efficient offensively in the series outside of Game 1. It's been a slog. It's been a lot of one-on-one or just boring high pick and roll for them. And they've been able to score okay, but not amazingly. And they've had to work incredibly hard for their points. I mean, you don't see them get any system buckets. And when I say system buckets, I mean a play where you get an open shot because you ran a play, not because someone individually did something awesome. You know, I mean, you'll see Redick come off screens every once in a while, but Kawhi generally shuts that down. You know, they never get any kind of back doors or just easy passes at the rim. You know, it's always got to be someone making an individual play. So, you know, I think getting Hawes in there to provide some more spacing might allow for easier buckets, but you'd have to actually hit shots and defend, and there's a reason he's kind of been out of the rotation.
Yeah, there definitely is a reason he's been out of the rotation. Do you think... Something I think about sometimes is, do you think that playing such a tough seven-game series will have a meaningful impact on whoever wins this against the Rockets?
We've talked about this a little bit before we had that listener question. If guys are hurt, yes, and Blake might be a little bit, and Big Baby, but you know, if they had a sweep, those guys wouldn't have gotten hurt. It would have been over, but I don't really think it'll make that big of a difference. Frankly, you know, I've never seen anything that's indicated that the rest issue is a big issue, especially when you control for the fact that better teams usually win the previous series in less games.
Yeah.
So I don't make much of it.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is that the Clippers have been pushing their starters and their core guys so hard that it's possible there would be a little bit greater likelihood of them having a cumulative effect, but even then, I don't think that's going to be determinative. It just could be a small factor that helps the Rockets out, maybe in, let's say, games 1 and 2, which will be on the road for whoever wins this series.
Yeah, no, that's true. They'll be in Houston, and yeah, it's going to be an interesting series with the way Houston has looked so far. A couple more notes here before we kind of wrap things up on this game. The Clippers had some success switching stuff a lot, but they also kind of failed to execute that a few times. Matt Barnes in particular flubbed a lot of switches and also was caught really over-helping a lot too, whether it was on guys like Splitter, just non-judicious help basically, where guys just were not in a threatening position. They might have been in the paint, but they were easily controlled, or someone else was there to help off someone less threatening. And so he gave up a lot of open shots in that scenario. But he also played great individual defense on Kawhi for most of the game, and then Kawhi, at only 3 out of 15 for the game, wasn't able to take advantage of Barnes or even being matched up against Crawford for much of the time as well, because Redick was usually on either Green or Marco Bellinelli. So it'll be interesting. I mean, the Clips still made their share of mental mistakes, but they're able to just play hard enough and get enough individual brilliance to get past them.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting to see if they can stretch into Game 7 on what's going to be a pretty remarkable sports day.
Yeah, it is. So I guess we'll get to now the Bulls-Bucks game.
Do we have to?
Yeah, of course. It's basketball. It's our jobs, man. Come on. We're excited about it. It's one of the most remarkable games in NBA playoff history.
That's fair. I'll give it that.
Yeah, so I guess the question was, you saw the first half at least, I know, and that was obviously the only competitive portion. What do you make of this for the Bulls going forward? They've played obviously unbelievable defense all game. Is this sustainable? Can they do something here with this, or is it just a bad they all are on by the Bucks.
I think this was one of the best games I've seen the Bulls play in a long time, and that's a great thing for them in the first half. Obviously, you know, the final score is the final score, but they were making everything hard, and they were doing a nice job also on executing on the other end. I was very impressed with their all-around game. Dunleavy in particular early on, punch included, did what his team needed, and they got quality contributions all over. Pau Gasol had a really kind of impactful block in the second quarter. I think it was on Carter Williams, but it was one of those kind of plays that you thought, oh, if the Bucks could get this, maybe they'd bring their fans in a little bit more, and then he just snuffed it out. It was just done. And I thought the Bulls, that you can sustain some of that. Obviously, we're going to be getting a very different Cleveland team than we have seen basically at any point this year. So, yeah, I definitely think there are things they can take away from it. However, even without Kevin Love, I would say that they're going to be facing a substantially more potent opponent and on the road for the first two games. So we'll have to see how much carries over. But, I mean, Chicago's going to have a chance in game one, considering that you also have the J.R. Smith of it all.
Yeah, although it wouldn't completely shock me if Dunleavy weren't around for game one after that little neck punch that he managed to give to Carter Williams, and then he had another shot to the face of Giannis, the cumulative effect of those, and then the way that Giannis ended up getting so frustrated that he got ejected for that flagrant two when they're already down 30. After, you know, 3 seconds after Dunleavy had already shot a three, he just basically checked him into the stands.
Can we call that an Andrew Bynum? Is that fair?
Yeah. You know, that's when your team is getting blown out in a closeout game and you just kind of get frustrated and don't want to be around anymore. Yeah, I think we can call that an Andrew Bynum.
A mega frustration foul, and he can still have a big man shooting a completely insane three. That can also be an Andrew Bynum too. They're different enough that we can get it by context.
Yeah, so I would say what the Bulls did, I think even more than they had at any point previously, was they were switching just about everything. I don't recall them doing it that much with Gasol, but everyone else who played as a big guy, they went to that. Mirotić barely played in the first half, hardly at all, because I think just everyone else was being successful. I don't know whether that was a specific tactic that Coach Thibodeau was going to adopt coming in or not, or whether he just decided to go with what was working. I do worry slightly that there might be some fool's gold here for the Bulls, where they now are going to be more likely to stick with that two-center starting lineup. Kirk Heinrich played a lot of minutes over Tony Snell, and the Bulls did well in those minutes, although I honestly can't say that I saw Heinrich do a lot to actually cause that. He's still, his main problem on offense is that he passes up a lot of three-pointers, dribbles into less efficient twos, or just, doesn't end up getting any kind of shot at all because the offense is built for him to take an open three, and he doesn't, and they don't end up getting a shot on there. So I don't think that it's going to be good to see him playing a lot, especially at the two. I actually wouldn't have minded them playing him at the one a little bit more, where his lack of shooting doesn't hurt as much, and he could have guarded Carter Williams. But nonetheless, it was a dominating performance for the Bulls. I shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth too much, perhaps. And hopefully this kind of defense will be sustainable, but this is going to be a totally different animal for them on both ends, really. I mean, they should be able to score much more easily, but they're also going to have a much harder job playing defense, especially if the Cavs wise up and go with the good shooting lineup with LeBron at the four right out of the gate.
Yeah, and also playing Kirk Heinrich, assuming Blatt defends him correctly by putting the worst guy they have, a.k.a. Kyrie Irving, on him, I feel like that would be a much greater downside in that series just because of the way that Cleveland's team is structured.
Yeah, the Bucks D wasn't what it had been. Granted, it wasn't helped by the fact that they couldn't score to save their lives, but they weren't helping off the guys who needed to be helped off nearly enough. The Bulls were getting a lot of shots at the rim. They were getting shots in transition. The Bucks turning it over a lot didn't help much either, but it was certainly not what anyone was expecting. I actually made the Bucks very slight favorites in this game in my mind, and I guess it's good to see from a Bulls team that really did struggle to blow out lesser teams the way you would have thought they should have all year. So another thing was that 2 days rest, Derrick Rose was fantastic. He had 7 assists in the first half, was able to get to the basket some, really play make a lot for the Bulls. So, and he'll have plenty of rest before the first game, although it'll be every other day after that.
Yeah, and as I understand it, except for this really weird gap in the Warriors-Grizzlies series, the series are largely every other day, so that means we're going to see less of that. But as you said, we will get it at the beginning.
So the one last thing we have to get to is that... one other thing, too. At one point in the third quarter, the Bucks only had a 6% offensive rebounding rate, which against a Bulls team that wasn't that great on the defensive glass... it was pretty poor. But Coach Thibodeau, the main point was that the Bulls are up 41 with 7:34 left in the third quarter. He continued to play Derrick Rose. Finally got Rose out of there. He only played 25 minutes. He was out of there by, you know, about 4 minutes left in the third. But he came back with Noah, who, don't forget, was on a minutes limit, has really struggled with his knee. And also with the Bucks kind of just headhunting guys as well, with all the kind of cheap shotting that had been going on, it was time to get the starters out of there, and really get anyone of value out of there. And Thibodeau just didn't do that. I mean, Noah played almost until half the fourth was gone, and it was. I've defended Thibodeau more than I think a lot of other people have on the whole minutes thing. At least for full game total minutes in the regular season, where I think it's okay to play guys 40 minutes sometimes if you need to. But this was really more indefensible than anything. And he was asked about it after the game, and about keeping his starters in when he was up 40. And he said, well, you get worried that they might come back. They might hit some threes. You know, you got to take a shot. The Bulls were up by 39 points going into the fourth quarter. The Bucks have only had two 39-point quarters where they scored 39 points the entire season. And that would assume that the Bulls scored 0 points. There was no chance they were coming back, literally none, and yet Noah and Gibson are still out there. Gibson, another guy,
Heinrich. If it happened, you know. It's not like it would be a pretty long road to go. You know, you could put him in when you're down, when you're up 20, and you'd be fine.
I mean, the Bulls could have inbounded the ball into the front court and just had a guy hold it in the fetal position for 24 seconds on every possession, and they would have won the game. Like, they're
going away.
Yeah, going away. I mean, you get maybe 25 possessions, you know, so they would have had to score 39 points at 25 possessions and hold the Bulls to 0 points too. Like, there's just no way. So it was pretty ridiculous. I mean, Heinrich missed game one. He's been really struggled with a sprained knee. Like, he was out there. Why? There's literally no good explanation for it.
Moving a little bit to the Bucks. This game taints it a little bit, but what did you see from them in terms of their long-term future? Because obviously we expect them to do better down the road than they did this year.
A lot of it just depends on what Jabari and Giannis, and maybe to a lesser extent Carter Williams, can turn into. I think they have a nice system in place. They're still going to need a real long-term option at center, someone who can protect the rim a little bit better. Henson is too slight a build to really be the answer there. Pachulia is too old. Larry Sanders is now no longer on the team. So they're going to need more at center. And Middleton, obviously, they're going to have to re-sign. I fully expect that to happen. And they'll have some cap space this summer. It's a decent center market. So they're going to need more shooting, and they're going to need someone to protect the basket. And then if you can get that, then you just hope that those guys become what everyone hopes that they can be.
Yeah, I'm excited for them. I also think Jason Kidd has done a good job coaching this team, and I think that it'll be good to see what he can do really maintaining a culture, because I thought he did a nice job last year with the Nets, but he didn't have to maintain anything, and he already had guys that had done it. Now he has to, you know, really establish a foundation and continue augmenting that foundation.
So we got a little bit of news to talk about today, too. Well, actually, why don't we get to one question that I neglected yesterday. I was saving it to see until we saw what happened in today's Bulls game. This is actually from an old buddy of mine, Mike Munson in Chicago, who used to play with me in this pretty fun lawyers basketball game. Fun, at least for lawyers who like to argue, maybe not for basketball players who like to just play basketball. It was a little weird setup in this league because, or this game, because anytime you got fouled in the lane, you would get a point.
Oh, and God. So
the argument over whether someone took off from, like, in the lane or not was always hilarious. But there are some older guys, I think they just enjoyed the opportunity to stop the game and, like, catch their breath or whatever. But that game was noteworthy because every once in a while, our now Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, who, if you ever watched the Celebrity Games, is a wonderful basketball player. He used to play in that and used to kick my butt. I used to have to guard him, and didn't work out too well. So, anyway, Mike says he's a lifelong Chicago guy, a bit of an over-hashtag user, unfortunately. No hashtag love for hashtag Bulls getting to the finals. Optimistically, still could get it together with everyone healthy. What do you think? Can the Bulls make it to the finals?
Absolutely. They can. I mean, you're in a situation where I think they have a pretty good chance. I wouldn't call them the favorites in the next series. I think it's real close, though. And then I haven't seen anything to make me say, oh, the Hawks would definitely wipe the floor with the Bulls. I think that the Hawks, if we're getting what we saw in Game 5 from them, I think that's a lot closer to what the reality is for them. But I would say that they have a respectable shot in that series, too. Is that pretty much how you have it? Or would you have the Bulls as the favorites against the Cavs?
No, I would not. I think the Cavs, especially, I think a lot of it depends on if the Cavs wise up or not. If the Cavs decide to go with their big lineup and play that big minutes because they, you know, JR is out or the Bulls start two centers or whatever, I think that would be a huge mistake. If they play the lineup with LeBron at the four or, you know, get some shooters around him, whoever it is, especially going up against that two-center lineup for at least 12 minutes a game, I think that the Cavs can still win, especially with them having home court. So and Rose having to deal with the rest. I think Rose could actually make some hay in this series, but you know he's been so bad on short rest that it's hard to anticipate that other than in game one. So I would say you know maybe the Bulls have a 35-40% chance in that series and maybe 40-45% chance in that Hawks series. So not totally completely unrealistic, but I don't think, especially also because I don't think they're going to use Mirotić that much. I don't see that as a very likely possibility. You know, maybe 15% chance, 20% chance of them making it to the finals at this point. Not much chance against the Western representative.
No. One other addendum to this in terms of the schedule we've been talking about it. The schedule that I've seen is that the series starts on May 4th, so that gives Rose and the Bulls a couple days. But then it's every other day until Game 7 where there would be 2 days off. So that goes in with a line of 2 days rest of Derrick Rose. It would only be the first and the last game if it goes 7.
So we can now get back to Billy Donovan. He has been officially hired, reported as a 5-year, $30 million deal.
Wow.
Last year, a team option. So that's a little bit of a raise from what he got from Florida, which we would have expected, but also pretty much along the lines of what you would have expected coaching salaries. I mean, Steve Kerr got pretty close to $5 million a year from the Warriors, never having coached before. Donovan already having a job that was paying him $4 million. They had to pay him more to get him. But he and Sam Presti apparently know each other pretty well. And there was a nice profile on Donovan's coaching style from Anthony Slater that maybe makes you feel a little bit better about what he could eventually be.
Yeah, they talked about his history and his connection to Rick Pitino, but they spent more time kind of getting into the nuts and bolts and how Donovan put out a video about pick and rolls, which I thought was a very interesting thing. And also, I think it's been very nice how his former players have been very supportive of him. And while you would expect that just because it's a collegial game and those guys, especially in college, they chose to play with him. So there's a much greater connection between coach and player in that time. I think that's been nice. And he does have a pretty wide NBA net at this point, just because of how well collections of his players have done in the league and how prominent they are now.
Yeah, a lot of what the article talked about was that he really enjoys giving his players freedom.
Yep.
He likes to run pick and roll a lot, likes to spread the floor. We talked about his experience with the 24-second clock working in FIBA before. It might be interesting to see if they try and do anything more with pressure since he comes out of that patina background. I don't think that they will, but we'll see. Another thing that I thought was interesting is just for Donovan on a personal level, to me, this is a no-brainer move. I mean, Florida really struggled last year, 16-17. Don't have any huge five-star recruits in the pipeline. Haven't gotten any really in a while. Casey Hill's really the only guy who was up there, and he hasn't quite panned out the way a lot of people would have hoped for him. So with Florida stagnating, 2 years from now, what if, you know, the bloom is off the rose, so to speak, for him there, and he might actually be in trouble with his job there. Much better to go to the NBA now, get paid even more, take a dream job. And you know what? If Durant and Westbrook leave, so be it. You can always go back to college and get the same level of job that you had now. If you wait and Florida starts doing poorly and you're not nearly as in demand, then maybe you can't go to the pros then. Certainly not for a job where you're going to get to coach this level of talent. So it's really a no-brainer move for him, especially because he's already, you know, he's coached in college for, what, 18 years or whatever, at Florida, and he's won two national titles and had a ton of success. So I totally understand where he's coming from here. I mean, you know, if he fails here, he can always go right back to doing what he was doing before, probably even potentially had as good or better of a job than Florida is.
Yeah, I agree with that. From Donovan's perspective, it's a great move because he gets, not only is he getting a chance in the NBA, he's getting a great job. Like it's very different than even the Orlando job that he accepted and the whole shenanigans with that. But he gets this, and if those guys leave, nobody's going to blame him unless something crazy happens. And as you said, he can go back to college any day of the week, and he can get a great job. I mean, I've said for selfish reasons I'm a proud UCLA alum. I'd take him in a heartbeat, you know, if he ever wanted to go back to college. And most people consider that a relatively decent job. And I think that you're going to get this opportunity, and he also will have some, if he wants to run something defensively that is more built on effort and things like that, he has a really nice core for it. They have some fun pieces, but I'm very intrigued by Enes Kanter in all of this because they gave him a lot of leverage by trading for him in the way that they did and him hitting restricted free agency. And I don't know that there are any other teams that are in love with him enough to make the kind of offer that would make this very uncomfortable for them. But if somebody does, let's say somebody drops 12 to 13 million for Enes Kanter, you're in a really tough way if you're Oklahoma City.
Yeah, they're going to be deep into the luxury tax. If they re-sign him or in the eight figures, I haven't run the numbers in the last couple of months, you know, kind of updating it, but I think they'll be up to about $15 million in tax payment. They're soon be paying Scott Brooks. They got $6 million now for Donovan. So, you know, maybe ownership is opening the purse strings now, assuming that they do, in fact, re-sign Kanter. Maybe they don't for that reason. But, hey, you know, it might have been nice if you, instead of spending all this money now, you spent another $3 or $4 million on James Harden 3 years ago. But,
And then they have to max out Dion Waiters next summer.
Yeah, that's good. It's good that we have, you know, a 2-day break so we can leave the listeners with that incredible thought of maxing out Dion Waiters. Let's call it quits for now. We will be back on Sunday wrapping up game one of Grizzlies Warriors. We might even do that from the arena. And, of course, the Spurs Clippers Game 7, which I cannot wait for. Till then, guys.